Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law podcast for June 2013. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. The largest battle to date in the smartphone and tablet wars has been the U.S. case of Apple v. Samsung. Apple and Samsung are huge players in the smartphone market. In 2012, their combined sales were more than half of smartphones sold worldwide. People buy Apple iPhones and iPads because they look cool. Products that look cool should be protected in the United States by design patents. Such was the case in Apple v. Samsung. Chris Karani is a partner at McAndrews Held & Molloy in Chicago, Illinois, and is recognized as an expert in design law. Chris has written and spoken extensively on the Apple v. Samsung case, including an article in the January-February issue of Landslide magazine, a publication of the ABA's IP section. Chris also spoke about the Apple v. Samsung case and other design cases at the spring meeting of the AIPLA in Seattle in May 2013. I spoke with Mr. Karani from his office in Chicago. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Don.
So why did the Apple and Samsung decision capture so much attention?
Well, probably most fundamentally, as far as on a broad spectrum, capturing the attention of the media and the public's attention was the fact that the devices that were implicated are the devices of our time, tablets and smartphones. So I think that there was a great understanding of folks and familiarity with the devices, which is often very different from a lot of the other intellectual property cases, which might deal with things much other than consumer products that people are accustomed to using.
And there were a large number of damages awarded in as well, correct?
Certainly, and it was a whopping jury verdict indeed at the time, the largest standing patent infringement jury verdict of all time, whether a design patent or utility patent, and it was a bold and decisive jury verdict, $1.05 billion damages award. Later in the program, we can get to exactly how that number got to such a large amount.
And this case got to trial pretty quickly as well, didn't it?
It moved along at a quick clip. I mean, if you look at some of the inceptions or the seeds of the case go back to 2007, this is pre-filing. The case is filed not until 2012. But you're talking about this the battles, the smartphone wars competing between Apple and even Nokia at the time, Samsung sort of nibbling at their heels, both Apple and Samsung's productivity increasing until you get to right about 2011. That's when you start seeing Samsung moving ahead of Apple with respect to its the sales, and as far as the slope of its ascent starts increasing quite sharply right around 2011. And it's at that time that Apple decides that this is a boiling point. We need to do something about it. And when they do, they move the judge to try to shorten the trial, the time for the trial, and also moving for a preliminary injunction. We can get into that in a bit.
Okay. Now, what was at issue in terms of different IP rights?
That was one of the curious parts about the case, is that really was the entire sort of patent thicket. You had utility patents involved in the case. You had design patents involved in the case. You had registered trade dress. You had unregistered trade dress. And there was certain some FRAM patents even coming back with respect to counterclaims. But all of those IP rights being forwarded and handled at the same time allowed for a lot of interesting lawyering because there were certain defenses, certain arguments you might be able to make in the confines of one intellectual property right that would not be permitted in another. But because they were all there, it really allowed a lot of opportunity for lawyers to sort of deftly move around and sort of get creative with the arguments that they were pulling in.
Let's focus on the design patent aspect of the case. Would you say this was the biggest design patent case ever?
You know, without a doubt. The most high-profile design patent case, and I guess I would even forward that with respect to any intellectual property case, I think the argument could be made that this Apple v. Samsung case was the most high-profile intellectual property case of all time. Indeed, there was skits on the Colbert Report and skits on Conan O'Brien dealing with Apple v. Samsung. So rare is the case that you would have an intellectual property case being spoofed on one of these late night TV shows. Certainly rare the case that it would be regarding design patents.
Now, trial lawyers say that every case should have a narrative. What was Apple's story for the jury?
I suppose in short was that Samsung slavishly copied, that was the term that they used, slavishly copied its design. And we can sort of get into the details of that, but the mantra and the theme of the presentation before the jury was, here is iPhone, it was released in 2007, and they say show this visually. And they had three panels. The center panel showed iPhone 2007 being released. They then showed what the Samsung phones looked like before 2007, the designs, and you know you can see that they're much busier design, if you will, than the more minimalist design of the Apple iPhone design. And then in the third, the right-hand panel, they would show what the Samsung devices looked like after. And they interestingly were using actual commercial embodiments of the earlier Samsung phones and the iPhone, which if this was purely a design patent case, one could argue that that was the improper improper analysis, that it rather should be a comparison of the patent drawing to the accused product, irrespective of any type of commercial aspect or what was shown on the screen, on the home screen, but rather just using the static line drawings from the design patent itself. But that was definitely the theme, showing what the Samsung life designs look like for both the tablet and the iPhone and the smartphone before and after the release of the Apple products.
And what was Samsung's overarching argument?
Well, I think that a lot of what Samsung was arguing was that indeed the form factor or the design elements in these cases are largely a function of how they have to look. You know, if you're going to have a touch screen, you're not going to want to have buttons on the screen. That the rounding of the corners has a purpose because you don't want to have it snagging on the corner of your pockets. The fact that the top surface is flat is has a reason and has a function, and all of those things sort of lead to the point that this wasn't as much design as Apple wants us to believe, but rather sort of the logical extension of functional concepts. And then I think secondly was that indeed there was many other designs that were out there, that the Apple design didn't come out of thin air. And I think Samsung's attorneys did a pretty good job unearthing prior art from around the globe showing that, you know, there was similar designs that we shouldn't be using as the prior art what other Samsung devices look like, but rather the sort of universe of prior art, and that there was somewhat similar looking designs that existed in the past.
Now, was that the right approach to look at the functionality of each of the design elements?
Well, this is a big issue with respect to design patent jurisprudence, not only in the United States, but as I look globally at the different design law systems around the world, I think this is one of the unanswered questions, is how do you deal with the issue of functionality? It sort of breaks down into two discrete inquiries, in my opinion. First is whether or not the design right, let's say a design patent as we call them in the U.S., the design patent right is valid. And the test there is pretty well settled, that you look at the overall appearance of the claim design, whether or not it's dictated by its function. Is this the only way that this can look? If it is indeed the only way, then the thought at least is that it's usurping the province of utility patents. In other words, that's really just a functional item, because that's the only way it can look. But if you can show that there's alternative designs, other ways that this can look, then that the fear or the concern against sort of monopolizing a function through a design patent evaporates. Now, that's the first inquiry, the overall, the validity. There is a second area that has sort of crept into U.S. jurisprudence after a case in 2010 called Richardson v. Stanley Works, which deals with functionality of individual elements of the design. So the first one is the overall appearance. Now you're going to go to a granular level and look at individual elements. And this was largely one of the strategies that Samsung used. Of course, the case is coming after Richardson, so they were just doing really what the Federal Circuit had sort of allowed them to argue this. But that area of what exactly, once you do identify functional features, what you should do with them, what is it? Does it mean to be a functional feature? Something can have a function, but does that mean that it is de jure, or does that mean that it is indeed purely functional in a legal sense? And this was one of the arguments that was being brought forth by Samsung. By way of example, you know, Samsung would argue that the speaker hole has to be in that particular location to line up with the human ear, that the corners had to be rounded, that the surface had to be flat, all these particular arguments. I think, you know, what Apple was countering with in that regard was that, no, each one of those particular features, they themselves could be designed differently. And here, the prior art shows a wealth of other examples. And moreover, here's our expert witness who can show you that there are indeed even other examples or alternatives. But yet, Samsung chose to use the design elements that we had set forth in our commercial product and also in our patented claim design.
Now, before we talk about the Apple design patents themselves that were at issue, what is the test for infringement of a design patent?
In the United States, the test for design patent infringement goes back to a case in 1871 called Gorham v. White, and was decided by the Supreme Court. And indeed, it's the first and last time that the United States Supreme Court has weighed in on design patent infringement, and it is to this day the law of the land. And in almost every design patent infringement case in the United States, you will see a citation to Gorham v. White. And what the test looks at is whether or not the two designs, the patented and accused design, are substantially the same, note just substantially the same, in the eyes of an ordinary observer. And that's in sort of paraphrasing the test. But the keys to that are, one, we're not looking for exactitude. It does not require that one's an exact copy of the other. It's substantial similarity. So for those patent attorneys, you'll be familiar with the term of the doctrine of equivalence, that there's sort of an equivalence built into the test for infringement. And then secondly, I think an important takeaway from Gorham v. White is that it's through the eyes of not an expert or someone versed in the trade that you're talking about, but rather through the eyes of an ordinary observer. And in this particular case, it was the men and women of the jury box using their everyday ordinary sensibilities and perceptions.
Now, you point out in your article that unlike utility patents, design patents are not an all elements test. Not all of the elements of the design have to be present in the defendant's product design in order to have infringement. So what's the strategy in terms of how many elements you claim or describe in your design patent as a strategy for the scope of coverage you might have?
Well, like any good attorney, I suppose I would answer the question by saying it depends. And probably one of the best ways is to get a range of coverage. And I think that's what we saw in this case here, is that if you look at the Apple patents, which we can get into in a moment, their design patents, from a strategy point, it's probably equally as interesting to look at the patents that were not asserted in the case. And from there, I think many people are trying to enter into the design patent game, but it wasn't just that Apple got sort of lucky that the jackpot lined up exactly with respect to the accused products on the design patents ensued. What really happened is that they had several design patents to choose from, all with varying scopes. And when you looked at it, maybe one particular design patent you would assert might help you on infringement because there was the most amount of points of convergence with the accused product, but it might also be the one that would line up best with the prior art, and so might have the most was the shakiest when it came to validity. So, how many elements to include? I think you have to sort of know where the prior art stands because you want to make sure you're beyond the prior art. And then when it comes to the comparison to the accused product, you know, you don't know ex ante what the defendant's product is going to look like. So I think what we saw in the Apple situation was some design patents they had a sort of a more of a paucity or less elements that were claimed. You can use dotted lines to disclaim things in the United States. While other examples, particularly here the graphic user interface, was included very much detail and nothing was disclaimed. It was claimed actually in full color without anything being disclaimed. When you claim something with more elements, it's entirely possible that you can find infringement even with a whole five or six elements missing or even more because it can absorb more because there's more chances for commonality between the accused and the patented design. If you've claimed less, even one difference can be enough to prevent infringement. It might be enough to change the overall appearance. So the lodestar in all of these cases is whether or not the overall appearance is substantially the same. And so really it depends which features have sort of a dominant visual effect upon the comparison between the two designs.
And how does the prior art play into an infringement analysis?
Well, quite considerably. This really changed upon the en banc Federal Circuit Court's decision in Egyptian Goddess v. Swissa, which came down September 22nd in 2008. And in this particular case, what the court decided was there used to be an old test, I won't get into it, called, in addition to the Gorham v. White, which is also known as the Ordinary Observer Test, there was a second independent freestanding test that needed to be satisfied for design patent infringement called the Point of Novelty test. And what that was looking at is sort of a comparison between the patented design and the prior art. They got rid of that test. They abrogated that test. And in its place, they said that the Ordinary Observer Test, the Gorham v. White, where you're looking at the patented design and the accused design, needs to be done in view of the prior art. And what this sort of means is that, you know, Don, if someone said, you know, do you and I look alike? Well, to a pack of elephants, we look a lot alike, okay? But to maybe if you had a twin brother, we don't look anything alike. So in a real sense, design patent infringement is a relative test. You're looking at two particular designs, determining whether or not they're substantially similar in view of the frame of context, which is the prior art. And that's one of the things I think that if you look at that opening slide that I was talking about with that Apple was using in the case, I think they were trying to exploit or perhaps highlight that point, is that look at how close the Apple and Samsung designs look like compared to what? Compared to that pack of elephants, namely the earlier Samsung designs.
So let's talk about the four design patents that were at issue in the Apple case. The first was the 677 design patent. What did it protect?
Right. So the 677 design patent was at stake, just sort of overarching. There was two smartphone industrial design patents dealing with effectively the iPhone 3, and then there was one industrial design looking at the tablet, and then a fourth one dealing with the graphic user interface, the GUI, that is used on the smartphones themselves. So three, I suppose, the tablet and the two smartphones dealing with industrial design, one, the graphic user interface dealing with graphic design. With respect to the 677, the 677 design dealt with the front face of one of the iPhone, of the iPhone 3 design. And particularly, which was claimed in the design itself, and was the front face, and it included this diagonal surface shading, which also is known as oblique line shading. What that denotes is a reflective, highly polished, transparent or translucent surface. And this is sort of set forth in the MPEP, the Manual for Patent Examination in the United States. And that is effectively a claim limitation. It's as if you want to think about this in utility patent parlance, when you're including that type of shading, you're specifying the character, the sort of the surface ornamentation of that particular surface. And that was critical because a lot of the prior art, which we were sort of talking about before with Samsung unearthed, those designs did not include edge-to-edge glass. Indeed, they had sort of what they called a picture frame type of design. You had a piece of metal that might go around the front face and the screen was inset within it. The 677 includes the diagonal oblique lines, which denotes edge-to-edge glass, okay, which was sort of a departure, if you will, from a lot of the prior art. And then also, it claimed this black cross-hatching that was on the front. And that was another drafting convention used to denote a black surface, so edge-to-edge black surface, which another way perhaps to set it apart from any type of prior art, which didn't really have edge-to-edge black. It would usually maybe be a frame and then a sort of an insert of a screen. So that was really the focus. It did not claim the bezel that went around the phone. It did not claim the backside. It was what we call a portion design patent, which is only claiming a portion of the entire design.
Now, the second design patent for the phone that you mentioned was the 087. What did it protect?
Very similar in respect. The same drawing, if you will, except it didn't specify edge-to-edge glass. In other words, didn't include the diagonal oblique line shading and didn't include this cross shading. So in that regard, it was, one could say, I suppose, broader because it didn't require those particular specific elements. But this one did claim the bezel that goes around the front face, so claiming particularly that it wasn't claiming the chrome aspect, but if you know what an iPhone looks like, the chrome bezel that goes around an iPhone 3 was claimed. Here again, the backside wasn't being claimed. Now, interestingly, in this particular claim, this particular design patent, whereas you are only allowed one claim in a design patent, different from a utility patent where you can have multiple claims, you are allowed to have multiple embodiments of the same design, so long as those multiple embodiments are patentably indistinct. So that sounds like a lot of double negatives in there, but the point is, do the various designs, do they all form basically the same design? Maybe you have a shirt that has 12 buttons on it and you want to file another one that has 13 buttons on it. I mean, the argument could be made, as long as the examiner said they fit together, that those all form the same design. There's a sort of a nominal change that might be between the two. Here, Apple had six different multiple embodiments in the 087 design patent. And what the different embodiments, the different designs, if you will, the different embodiments had was some claimed the home button on the bottom. Some did not claim the home button. Some claimed the speaker hole. Some claimed the screen border that was inset in the front face. And there was six different embodiments playing with those three different features, disclaiming and claiming the features, creating, in a sense, a broader design patent that had more teeth. Ultimately, it was the sixth embodiment, the sixth bullet, which Apple relied upon in its infringement charges.
That was, I think, the shape and placement of the upper speaker and the screen border. Is that right?
That's correct. So it omitted the sixth embodiment, claimed everything in solid lines on those elements we talked about before in the front face, but for the home button on the bottom. And that was dotted out. The circle home button was dotted out in the design patent in the embodiment 6. And that becomes important because if you look at any of the 26 accused Samsung devices, none of them have that circular home button down at the bottom. So, in effect, Apple was able to put off the table that point of divergence in designs. And what was remaining were pretty much all the points of convergence between the screen border, the speaker hole at the top, the sort of curvature of the corners, and the bezel that went around it.
Now, the third iPhone design patent was the 305. What did it protect?
The 305 speaks to the graphic user interface that is used with the iPhone family, and it effectively was claimed in. It was acclaimed in color, and so it's if you've seen a home screen, it's those icons that are arranged in rows and columns, sort of square boxes with icons. They call those square boxes containers in the icon lingo, and they were uniform, the shapes of each one of those boxes, but within each box they would have a camera or a note for music or a telephone for your phone function or an envelope for your email function. An array in a sort of variety of different colors on a black background with this gray border on the bottom where you have sort of your static icons that always remain there. That's what was claimed there. And this is quite cutting-edge subject matter when it comes to design patents. Indeed, this case, to my knowledge, represents the first and only design patent case that has reached a decision by a fact finder on a graphic user interface icon or animation.
And the fourth design patent was the 889. That was for the iPad. Is that right?
That's right. So that's on the iPad design, and this one goes back quite back some time. The other three design patents we talked about sort of have their priority right around 2007, just prior to the time when Steve Jobs took the stage at the Moscone Convention Center in early January of 2007 and unveiled iPhone. That's when those were filed. Well, and interestingly, the iPad design patent goes back about 5 years earlier. And in that design patent, these more progressive claiming techniques we talked about with multiple embodiments or multiple applications, surface shadings, and cross-hatching, dotted lines. None of that was used. It is a very straightforward design patent, 7 views of the design patent shown without any disclaiming any of the surfaces. And that was for the iPad tablet.
And as I understand it, there's either a mistake or an issue with respect to one of the drawings about whether the back was shiny or not. Is that right?
Right. So circling back to when I was talking about the drafting convention of the oblique lines, the diagonal shading, that was indeed used to denote the front surface of the iPad showing edge-to-edge glass, which was actually critical to, in my opinion, to sustaining the validity of the patent, because indeed there were other tablet devices which predated iPad. However, Samsung had some difficulty trying to find prior art which had edge-to-edge glass, and this was also something that came out during the trial, which was a challenge for Jonathan Ives and the design team at Apple and the other engineers to come up with the Gorilla Glass from Corning that sort of had the edge-to-edge aspect to it. But getting back to the point on the drafting was that on the back side of the device, there too there was some of this oblique line shading. And so whereas an Apple iPad device, the commercialized device, has a brushed aluminum back, which doesn't have a highly reflective polished surface on the backside, there was some confusion. In some of the drawings, it included the oblique line shading, and other ones it didn't. So this issue was one that Samsung was pushing, saying, hey, this patent fails because we can't determine what are the meets and bounds of the claim. There's these internal discrepancies. The judge did hear this. It wasn't to go before the jury. The judge decided in post-trial motions and said that on balance, one of ordinary skill in the art would be able to tell what are the meets and bounds of the claim. I would expect that on appeal that this is something that Samsung is going to re-raise.
So the judge decided that the protected design included the shiny back surface. And am I right? The jury decided.
That's right.
Decided there wasn't infringement because the back surface of the Galaxy was brushed aluminum.
You know, we don't know whether somewhat of a black box. The jury hasn't explained its answers, but that certainly could be, you know, something they could rest. Maybe their determination on. Now, let's remember that there is no all elements rule. Just because there's one particular design element missing, is not necessarily will prevent the finding of infringement. But that's something the jury could have taken into consideration. And, you know, I think one could argue that seeing that the judge herself had pointed out this specific feature was part of the claim design, the absence of that feature might have figured in prominently into the jury's decision.
Now, in your article, you say that the seeds of Apple's victory was planted when the iPhone first came out, and you quote Steve Jobs at the iPhone product launch in January 2007 as saying, "Today Apple is going to reinvent the phone, and here it is. Now we're going to start with a revolutionary user interface, and boy, have we patented it."
Yeah, isn't that something? I don't know if that struck people as much as it did myself or yourself as an intellectual property attorney, but I thought that was an interesting part of the sales pitch. And indeed, they did patent it. And I think part of the story, which is well known, is that Apple aggressively patented it. What type of patents they pursued might not be part of the story, which is so well known. They pursued about 200 patents on the iPhone, design itself. About 120 of those dealt with design patents. And that part of the story I don't think is so well known. And just there was such a focus on the importance of protecting the various aspects of the designs. And it was those seeds that were sown back in 2007 that came to fruition in the litigation here in 2012.
Now let's talk about the $1.05 billion damage award. How did it get to be so much?
Well, it is a hugely large award, and I think one of the things to keep in mind is, you know, what we're dealing with here as far as the industry. This is a massively growing industry as far as the amount of sales of smartphones and tablets between Apple and Samsung and the other players in the market. So that's one way I think that the numbers get so high when you're talking about just the sheer volume of sales, the products that are implicated by a case like that. Indeed, in this case, there was 28 different accused products in the case, 26 smartphones and two tablets. But there are certainly other utility patent cases where there are a lot of products implicated also. The unique aspect of it was a little chestnut in the Patent Act called Section 35 U.S.C. Section 289, 35 U.S.C. Section 289. And what that provides for is that for design patent damages, there are the traditional utility patent damages of reasonable royalty and lost profits available, but there is also an additional available remedy called disgorgement of profits. Now, you disgorge profits, and there are other jurisdictions, even in other areas of the law, there are disgorgement of profits where you don't look at your own, the patent holders or the intellectual property rights holders' lost profits, what they lost on the account of the infringement, but rather you look at the profits that were the ill-gotten gains, as the case law says, the ill-gotten gains that the infringer accrued on the account of its infringement. That's part of the story. But the other part of the story, so here we'd look at whatever Samsung's profits were from the case, but the other part is that there is without apportionment. So you're looking at the total profit is what the case law talks about. And that's really where you get the large number. So rather than trying to say, well, the design itself contributed to 10% of the product, and therefore of the sales, and therefore it should be 10% of whatever Samsung's profits were. That's not what happens in these design patent cases. Rather, you look at the total sales by the accused infringer minus their costs, and that's their total profit. And that's how you arrive at such a high number.
Now, I understand we're now in sort of the post-judgment world. What's happened to this case since the jury verdict?
So the judge has decided some of the post-trial motions. So there was arguments regarding validity and arguments regarding non-infringement and that the infringement findings were wrong. And the judge basically has deferred to the jury on the vast majority of those issues. On one particular issue where she did find some wrong was on some of the calculations with respect to the damages, which were at 1.05. She sliced those back down to about $600 million, saying that for those products that were implicated in that reduction, that there needed to be a retrial. So she's going to, in panel, and when I say she, this is District Judge, Honorable Judge Koh, Lucy Koh, she's going to impanel a jury in November of 2013 to determine the limited to the issue of damages with respect to about a dozen or so products and determine what should have been the damages with respect to the infringement of those products. One of the main issues at stake was what date did Apple give notice to Samsung such that the damages clock would begin ticking?
And that $600 million, I think you've said, might go up as a result of interest?
Yeah, so in a case like this, in a particular case like this, which has been, you know, since the jury's finding, or since even from the, you have pre-trial interest that can accrue, you have post-trial interest here, and there's been a long period of time, and particularly when you're dealing with, you know, huge sums of monies like this, it can actually compound over and over again. Also, there have been continued sales post-trial for some of the devices, so that also can be added back in, and those things that will have to be sort of a full accounting at some point here when we have a determination of this next stage.
So the fact that the products are still on sale, I take it no injunction was issued?
Well, the fact that we haven't had sort of a final appealable judgment in the case is also the reason why. There wasn't an injunction on those cases, and this is something that on the smartphones there wasn't. Earlier in the case, there was one on the tablet design. That was the one thing that the jury found that there was no infringement on, was on the tablet. So what the judge had to do was quite quickly was to lift the preliminary injunction, the injunction that was on the tablet that was going on during the pendency of the case, had to lift that. So at the moment, there is no injunction on any of the devices but would probably should be added that this is a fast-moving market, and you know, Samsung has continued to innovate and come out with new designs, new products. So largely, you know, even if we look at the design patent that was implicated in the case, you know, here we're talking about effectively the iPhone 3 design, but yet while that case is being litigated, you know, consumers are being confronted with iPhone 5 in the marketplace. So this might be one of those instances where, you know, the legal system, you know, might be prudent, but it certainly lags behind the consumer purchasing cycle.
Now, I guess everybody's heard of the Apple and Samsung decisions. Are you seeing much effect of that decision in other decisions?
From a legal standpoint, I haven't seen too much citation to the case. I've seen maybe a few citations to the case. I mean, I think judges have and litigants are certainly aware of the case. But at this point, it is a jury finding out of a district court, and it hasn't risen up to a federal circuit decision where you might have some precedential value to it. But in the private sector, and I suppose even in academia, and even in the public sector with respect to the U.S. Patent Office, you are seeing heightened interest in designs, and there can't be any question about that. Companies taking a second hard look at designs, saying, you know, we need to get this part of our IP arsenal. These rights do have teeth. This is evidence of it. You know, and even before the $1.05 billion judgment came down, the lion's share being attributable to design rights, I think that it was a victory, even the fact that the case went all the way to a jury for design rights. I think it probably surprised many that design rights had enough to, you know, withstand challenges to summary judgment, to just to take up an enormous amount of time with the court and the litigants. When, you know, before this, I think many probably would have dismissed the idea that a design patent could wreak this much havoc.
And coming soon, I assume, will be an appeal to the Federal Circuit.
I think so. I mean, there's so many of these issues, you know, and design law, if you look at design patent jurisprudence in the United States and even around the world, there really is a paucity of decisions, sort of well-reasoned, meatier decisions dealing with some of the more difficult issues. And it's largely because there's not a lot of sample size. A lot of design patent cases deal with either situations where you have a direct copy or knockoff, which typically will settle out, or situations where the dollar amount at stake, because quickly moving design cycles, might not merit fighting. It might just be a defendant might say, well, we'll just change our product and change the design of our product. But this case, because given what was at stake and the large amount of capital investment that goes into releasing these type of products, it did proceed. And so there's almost the entire body of U.S. design patent jurisprudence can be taught through this case. It touches on issues of validity and anticipation, obviousness, functionality, issues with respect to infringement and doctrine of equivalence and claim construction, and issues of damages and how you should calculate the infringer's profits in these particular cases, all across the board. And so what I'm anticipating is that there will be a large vetting of these issues up to the Federal Circuit, and it's going to be really interesting to stand by and see what they do.
Thanks very much for these insights, Chris.
Welcome, Don. I enjoyed chatting with you.
Chris Karani is a partner at McAndrews, Held & Molloy in Chicago, Illinois. For further information on Mr. Karani, on McAndrews, Held & Molloy, for a link to Chris's Landslide article on Apple v. Samsung, and for information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.